All journalists are manipulated and all politicians lie.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, what exactly is propaganda and why does it matter?
Why do politicians use propaganda?
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
We live in a political world. Love don't have any place. We're living in times where men commit crimes and crime don't have a face.
Why is propaganda more effective than rational persuasion?
Isn't propaganda just a trick method to sway public opinion?
There is no war.
Of course there's a war. I'm watching it on television.
Can you ever be persuaded to the truth by the use of propaganda?
Just remember, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Our guest is Jason Stanley, author of How Propaganda Works.
Why propaganda matters. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken teaches philosophy, and I taught philosophy for 40 years.
40 memorable years.
40 John. Memorable years.
Today, we're thinking about propaganda, how it works, and why it matters.
Well, propaganda is sort of like pornography, Ken. I'm not exactly sure how to define it, but I definitely know it when I see it.
Yeah, well, but what do you think of this definition from the Merriam-Webster's dictionary? It seems pretty straightforward to me. Propaganda, ideas that are often false or exaggerated and that are spread in order to help a cause, a political leader, a government, etc.
Well, that's sort of vague and not that helpful. I mean, not every false or exaggerated statement is propaganda. If I were to exaggerate for effect, something I would never do, that wouldn't make my statement propaganda.
That's a pretty clever refutation, John.
Secondly, propaganda, I mean, often what's said is true.
Give me a for instance there. I don't get that one.
Well, say a politician speaking at a rally says in a dark and foreboding tone, "There are Muslims probably right here among us now." What he says may be literally true, but his tone and context lends his statement the feel of propaganda.
No, I'm not sure. I mean, I grant you he's expressing disapproval, maybe even fear of Muslims, but is everything that expresses fear or disapproval propaganda?
He's not just expressing his own fears and prejudices. He's trying to get his audience to think and feel in the same way. That's what makes it propaganda.
But John, I don't know. I'm still not sure. Don't we all do that? Not just politicians, but poets, priests, and even ordinary people. Don't we all use language to induce attitudes and feelings in others?
Well, yeah. But, you know, when most of us, or poets or priests, talk or write that way, we're pretty upfront about it. Priests are supposed to tell us that they're being priests and poets are being poets. Propaganda is more insidious, more indirect.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, it parades as one thing while doing something else entirely. It pretends to be just stating cold, hard facts while it's really trying to covertly manipulate your thoughts and emotions.
Yeah, I kind of see what you're saying, but I don't think that covers all cases. Think of Nazi propaganda. There was nothing very covert or indirect about that, was there?
Well, when the state reserves the right to bludgeon you into belief, if you don't go along willingly, their propaganda doesn't have to be very subtle and insidious. It can be upfront and in your face.
Well, yeah, you know, I think I get your point. And I actually think this explains why people tend not to take propaganda seriously. Because in an authoritarian state, the official propaganda is very often full of falsehoods, sometimes such obvious falsehoods that no reasonable person could sincerely accept or believe it. But nobody questions it because it's backed by the state's iron fist. So, you know, yeah, they think that's mere propaganda.
But you can't get away with that sort of thing in a free and open society.
Well, I think that's exactly right. But doesn't that mean that propaganda can't really exist because it can't spread where information flows freely and opinion is uncoerced? So isn't free thought, the kind of thing we have here in the good old US of A, isn't that the antidote to propaganda?
No, I mean, I don't don't, I mean, not completely. It's, I wish it were that simple, but I mean, propaganda just has to get more subtle. I mean, you look on the pages of the New York Times and you see things that look like news reports, and then you notice way up in the corner it says advertisement. And that's usually propaganda. It presents itself one way, but it's really not. Take Fox News. Fair and balanced. We report. You decide. Now, I'm not saying this is a right-wing phenomenon, but it just happens that the right wing is very good at it right now in America. Fox News is a brilliant, extraordinarily lucrative, extraordinarily effective piece of pure propaganda.
Lucrative, I get, but brilliant? Come on. Effective? Come on, John.
Millions of eager viewers tune in every single day.
That just means there's a sucker, maybe millions of suckers born every day, every minute.
Well, don't just focus on the people tuning in. Focus on how Fox News gets them to tune in.
By telling them what they want to hear, obviously. It's simple.
Well, by representing itself as doing one thing while it really doesn't do it. It represents itself as what every independent news organization really ought to be. Willing to consider all sides of a debate, devoid of partisan agenda, relentless seekers of truth wherever it leads. The antidote to the one-sided biased reporting that many people think the liberal media represents. So, fair and balanced.
But you and I know, come on, we all know. They're pretty much the opposite of that in every single respect. Everybody knows that.
Well, not to the people who tune in. They don't think they're being fed a one-sided diet of spin. They think they're getting fair and balanced diet of truth from Fox News.
Well, what's your point? I'm not quite sure of your point.
Well, if they were honest and upfront about what they were actually doing, said, hey, we're going to give you the right-wing perspective on everything, they wouldn't be nearly so successful. In a supposedly free and open society, when you can't bludgeon people into thinking and feeling what you want them to think and feel, you have to be more subtle. You have to catch them unawares. You have to seduce them with democratic-sounding ideals and then gently, well, not always so gently, lead them where you want to go. And believe me, it's not just Fox News that does this.
Gosh, John, you know, this is complicated and interesting stuff. Really amazing.
Well, to give us a close-up look at propaganda in action, we sent our roving philosophical reporter Shuka Kalantari to explore how propaganda experts use language to sway public opinion. She files this report.
It's 57 degrees outside. It's Sunday. I have brown eyes. These are all facts. There's not a lot of room for arguments or opinion. But when there is room for debate, and there usually is, propaganda is pervasive. Take poverty in America, for example. Here's Fox News' take on the issue, courtesy of The Daily Show.
America's poor are actually living the good life.
A nation of takers.
We have conditioned people to look to the government to be their answer for every problem they have and take zero responsibility.
The moocher class.
Subsidized freeloaders.
Give me these goodies. Give me a cell phone. Pay my rent.
You get the picture. According to the Fox News narrative, America's poor are a bunch of lazy leeches. But MSNBC paints a very different picture.
The Thanksgiving table for many Americans weren't bursting with turkey and trimmings this year. The new poor are finding it harder and harder to make ends meet. They're working class families turning to government assistance to put
food on the table.
MSNBC uses terms like working class families and the new poor. Fox News prefers more subtle phrases like moocher class and nation of takers. But whichever way you spin it, they're both forms of propaganda.
In reality, it's not what you say that matters, it's what people hear.
That's Frank Luntz. He's a Republican pollster and a propaganda expert. He helps politicians get what they want by teaching them how to manipulate words. For example,
the word imagine. Imagine is putting language into the eyes and the ears of the person that you're trying to reach out to. If I asked you, imagine, what it would be like if we had a government that was actually accountable and responsible and delivered measurable results, you'd imagine the kind of government that I think conservatives want to create. But you begin with the word imagine, because then it's not your words and your vision that you're communicating, it's their words and their vision.
Luntz is also the guy who came up with the term energy exploration to replace oil drilling. Drilling for oil is bad for the environment. Energy exploration sounds like something Dora the Explorer would do. Luntz talks about keywords that can sway public opinion in an online tutorial promoting his book, Win. He says the phrase, the simple truth, is a perfect way to begin and end a budget deficit debate.
The simple truth clarifies complicated issues. We know, for example, that we spend $3.7 trillion every year. We know that we take in $2.2 trillion. The simple truth is, we can't live like this. The simple truth is, we cannot continue to spend more than we take in. It destroys the country. When you use the phrase, the simple truth, you've now clarified it.
Clearly. Then there's the powerful phrase, you decide. That's a Fox News favorite.
The beginning of change or the end of capitalism. Bringing them home or giving up the fight. Path to freedom or gateway for terrorism. You decide.
You decide. It's your life. It's your health. It's your future. It's your well-being. It's your quality of life. However you want to define it, you then end with the phrase, you decide. That communicates to them that you're in control of your life, and that's one of the highest values, highest priorities that Americans have today.
These days, Frank Luntz is a master of using language to shape politics. 70 years ago, George Orwell wrote, "Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind." Are Orwell's words truth or propaganda? You decide. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. The simple truth is, lots of propaganda out there. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about propaganda. We're joined now by Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy from Yale University. He's author of How Propaganda Works. Jason, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much, Ken and John. Great to be back.
So Jason, I associate you with deep and fascinating passions we share, like implicit variables in natural language. How did you get diverted from that fascinating topic over to something like propaganda?
Well, believe it or not, language has been a fascination for me because of its potential political implications. I grew up in a household with two parents who were both Holocaust survivors. My father was a sociologist who left Berlin when he was seven, and my mother lived through the war. And she worked in the she was a court stenographer in criminal court. So through her, I started thinking about the example of mass incarceration. And through my father, I was riveted by the very philosophical question, how do educated, intelligent people do things that they should clearly know are wrong?
So that's a fascinating insight into how you got to this study. But now Ken and I had a little bit of difficulty, not our usual facile discussion, in saying really what propaganda is. Can you give us a precise definition?
Sure. Well, I think that in describing social reality, these are technical terms, then we want to have a way of defining these technical terms so that they most make sense of social reality. There's different definitions people have given of propaganda, but I choose ones that I think are most important to understand propaganda in what you guys called free and open societies, since societies that take themselves to cherish the ideals of freedom and tolerance and openness. So I give I have two different notions of propaganda: undermining propaganda and supporting propaganda. Supporting propaganda is the kind of thing you guys talked about happens in authoritarian societies, and also here during wartime, waving the flag, explicit appeals to nationalism, for instance, without argument, like, or explicit appeals to fear. That just takes an ideal and tries to reinforce that ideal, like patriotism, mm-hmm. by waving the flag or marches. And that's what happens in authoritarian countries. Here, undermining propaganda is more important, as John was saying, to understand what's happening in free and open societies. Undermining propaganda appeals to a cherished ideal. Like Frank Luntz said, in our society, we cherish the ideal of liberty, of deciding ourselves. So a lot of propaganda in our society comes presented with via the ideal of liberty. So it undermining propaganda takes a cherished ideal and uses it in an argument for a goal that actually undermines that ideal.
So you think of you decide, we report, you decide, fair and balanced. That's kind of undermining propaganda. But, you know, we're going to have to dig into this, and I want to get under the hood of it. We want to get under the hood in the next segment. So we'll come back shortly. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about propaganda with Jason Stanley from Yale University.
In our next segment, we look under the hood of propaganda and examine the linguistic and political mechanisms used to spread it. Does propaganda work differently in a free and open society than it does in a closed, autocratic one? Is there such a thing as good propaganda, or is propaganda intrinsically bad?
How propaganda propagates, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Propaganda. That's exactly what we're talking about right now. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Jason Stanley. He's from Yale University, and he's the author of How Propaganda Works.
So, how propaganda works, Jason. We want to try and dig under the hood, as it were, of propaganda. We want to see up close and personal how it works. You've mentioned these two kinds of propaganda. I forget what the positive one is, supporting propaganda or something like that, and undermining. Let's start with undermining propaganda, since you claim that's what happens in a supposedly free and open society. Give us an example of what you think of as a particularly effective piece of propaganda, and show us up close and personal how it works. Let's walk through an example here.
Okay, since the show began with Frank Luntz, why don't we use one of Luntz's examples? So in 2003, the Luntz Research Companies did a report for Israel about Israeli communication priorities, about how to talk to the American public, to so-called opinion elites. And Luntz emphasizes that Americans want to see Israeli politicians being reasonable and being empathetic towards Palestinians. So he recommends the soundbite: "We are hoping to find a Palestinian leadership that really does reflect the best interest for the Palestinian people." And the reason he does, as he explains, is he says, this soundbite expresses, it shows that it's you're being empathetic, or suggests you're being empathetic, while at the same time undercutting the Palestinian leadership's bargaining position.
Because, I mean, I think I get your point, because... Well, is this the downside? If there's a we're looking for this kind of leadership, and we're really trying sincerely and hard to find this kind of leadership. So if we're not working with those guys, that shows they're not this kind of leadership, and so are not
precisely.
To be. Right.
Precisely.
So it's indirectly implying things that it wants people to believe, but that's a pretty common strategy. Is that always propaganda?
No, what it does is it appeals to a norm, reasonableness, being reasonable, taking every perspective into account, and then it actually undercuts that norm because it undercuts taking the Palestinian perspective into account.
But let's think of how does it do that? Because, I mean, it could be true that those Palestinians are not reasonable. Right. And if those Palestinians were not reasonable, that would justify, even though we're looking for a reasonable leadership, even though we're sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Right. So, I mean, how does it, you know what I mean? Because either it's true that either it's untrue that they're reasonable, or it's true that they're reasonable. The statement and the together with the action implies they're unreasonable. But is that necessarily false? You know what I mean? Does it matter?
I know exactly
that,
what you mean.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question is: does the Palestinian leadership actually take Palestinian interests into account? Because being reasonable means taking everybody's perspective into account. So the Israelis are reasonable only if they take the Palestinian perspective into account. Now, what this soundbite does is it implies that the Palestinian leadership does not truly represent the Palestinian interests. And really, the Israelis are representing the Palestinian interests. So it expresses reasonableness. We're taking the Palestinian interests into account, but we imply that the Palestinian leadership doesn't have the Palestinian interests into account. So your question is, what if the Palestinian leadership doesn't have the Palestinian leadership people's? Then it isn't propaganda.
So Jason, it's not going to come to a surprise to our usual listeners that we're probably, I mean, I'm an unreconstructed hippie and Ken's just a younger version of the same thing. But we do try to question everything, including our own prejudices. So can you give us some uses of propaganda from the American left media so that we can try to be fair and balanced here?
Well, I think that skewing the debate by seizing the positive vocabulary is always something that that people try to do, propagandists try to do. So the abortion debate has propagandistic vocabulary on both sides: pro-choice, pro-life. Pro-choice represents the opponent's position in a completely unreasonable way, and pro-life does the same. So I think that's one example which the vocabulary has been
The way you phrase that and the way John put the question makes me have a worry. Pro-choice for pro-life. Okay, both sides have propaganda. Both sides are trying to represent the other side as unreasonable. Humans do that to each other. Is all political discourse propagandistic? What would non-propagandistic political discourse look like? Do you have a view about that?
Well, I don't think that all political discourse is propaganda in the technical sense of undermining propaganda, appealing to a particular ideal and then undermining it. But I think that because all of our words have social meaning to them, have what Sally Haslinger and others call social meaning, they communicate some message over and above the literal meaning, there's a real question about whether we can achieve the kind of straightforward political discourse that our democratic system seems to presuppose.
Yeah, which, let's push on that a little bit, because one of the things you're about political discourse and norms of political discourse, and this propaganda thing kind of, I think, is a message of somewhat despair, because we think we have this free, open, democratic society and our political discourse is just imbued with propaganda. You see it everywhere. But look, I'm still worried about the issue of whether one person's is there an objective fact here about what's propaganda and what isn't, right? Is one person's propaganda, because values are always contentious, right? Values are always subject to contestation. So if your speech embodies these values and communicates them as the only reasonable values, and my speech embodies those other values and communicates them as the only reasonable values, then aren't we just bound to see each other as propaganda spinners rather than shared discourse or something?
I think we are often bound, given the institutions we have, to see each other like that. That doesn't mean that we all are propaganda spinners. I think there are certain values. Take the use of liberty to defend the Confederacy. Well, if you're using liberty to defend the legacy of the Confederacy, you're using liberty to defend slavery. I mean, I don't think that this is what Frederick Douglass puzzles over in his famous speech, What is July 4th to the American Negro? You talk about liberty, but, you've already told us it extends to all humans. Well, how are we supposed to convince you? It's just is inconsistent with the – slavery is inconsistent with the ideal of liberty, and I think that is an objective fact. I think liberty cannot mean liberty just for white men, for example.
Thank God for that.
Let me see if I can get clear. Let me give you an example of something somebody said the other day. That's that young guy that's running against Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, right? Uh-huh. He said, banks that are too big to fail are too big to exist. And I immediately thought, gosh, that's right. That expresses my view perfectly. Mm-hmm. Now, was that propaganda? Was the word big kind of sneaking in there? Or was that an example of straightforward political speech to which we should all aspire?
Well, I'm not clear in how it would fit the characterizations of propaganda that I've given. I mean, it's not clear what ideal he is exploiting in saying it. I mean, it seems to be a straightforward kind of speech.
He's connecting into our feelings against big things while implicitly defending a government big enough to put big banks out of business.
Ah, that's very clever.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen that. Right. So you could say that he's appealing there to an ideology that he's appealing to ideals that favor small businesses over large businesses, that say that government isn't a business. He's appealing to a set of political views that are going to be. I think there's a fact of the matter about what those political views are and what they entail. So, you know, others might think that those political views are ideology and a distortion of the nature of democracy.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about propaganda with Jason Stanley from Yale University. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Sky in Kensington's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sky.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to be here. I just wanted to share an experience when I was traveling. I was backpacking in 1980 through Syria into Jordan, and they closed the borders. I happened to be staying with a young man, and the television was on in the background because they had closed the borders, and there was a dispute between OPEC and Syria and Jordan were pissed off at each other, and they closed the borders. There's a lot of propaganda, what looked to me like propaganda, military shows that were endlessly playing on all the televisions. And I asked my host about it. I said, what do you think about the propaganda? And his answer didn't make any sense to me. And it took me a minute to realize that he was talking about Western commercials, advertising. Mm. And it really got me thinking about propaganda in a whole different way for the rest of my life. So I'm just wondering what you all think about that.
Well, about advertising in particular, I'm not quite sure what you want us to think.
Well, his view in his society, what I realized is that when I said propaganda, he didn't know what I was talking about in terms of the military shows.
I see.
How wonderful our military is and how strong a Syrian military will protect us against, you know, Jordan.
I gotcha. So there's a cultural gap between the two of them, Jason. Sky saw the military stuff as propaganda. The Syrians saw our commercial advertising as propaganda, but not the military stuff.
So here's the thing. Advertising and propaganda are incredibly related phenomena. The theorists of public relations and advertising, such as Walter Lippmann and Bernays, are the fathers of propaganda studies. So it's one and the same. In my book, I give definitions of advertising and definitions of propaganda that show how they're related. But in advertising, you're always employing an ideal for, you know, you might have a commercial for an unhealthy food item that shows healthy bodies jumping up and down. And, you know, then they show you the unhealthy food item.
Right.
So that's going to be propaganda in my sense, a lot of advertising.
I wonder something about your view. There's propaganda, which is the attempt to, I think, you know, language that's intended to work this way. But there's also, the attempt and the success, there's a possible gap between the attempt and the success.
Right.
Right. It's not just that I use language this way that makes it effective propaganda. You have to be taken in by it. Right. You have to be led that way. And if I don't force you. If I don't compel you by, like in the authoritarian state, I can't bludgeon you into belief. How is it that this can work in a free and open society? Well, I mean, because you can't without the bludgeoning. How actually can it be successful?
So here's how it works. It works by positions of authority. Ray Langton has and Joseph Raz have discussed this at some length. So, in a free and open society, we often have experts coming on, so-called experts, dictating policy to us, and we want to defer to them because they're presented as scientific experts. For instance, an example I talk a lot about in my book, Super Predator Theory, John DiIulio, the Princeton political science professor. He came on and was presented as an expert on crime, telling us that there were these super predators who were mostly young black males.
Yeah.
And so we defer to him because he's expert.
But it's a free and open society. Suppose we have a million society in which there's the free exchange of ideas. No ideas are restricted. Nobody's restricting the counter-expert. In an authoritarian state, somebody would be restricting the counter-expert. Nobody restricts the counter.
People do not have the time. So we give we make bets upon who's an authority. And when authority figures abuse their authority, as so often happens in the history of mass incarceration, crack babies, the drug policy, a lot of that was experts misusing their authority. Who has the time to go do a whole bunch of research themselves to go see that, for example, they're giving these lab rats 100 times the doses of cocaine or methamphetamine that humans
So wait a minute, though. So it sounds like part of the conditions for the possibility of propaganda working where no mechanisms restricts intrinsically the free exchange and free flow of ideas is our kind of lazy acquiescence or something. It's something, it depends on us being a certain way, right?
Well, because I don't think lazy acquiescence is a fair way to put it. I think that we live in a society that makes democracy very difficult because we're given no free time to learn and research on our own. We're given no free time to be democratic citizens and do the research ourselves. So we have to give stuff to the experts.
Yeah, but I think in a way that seems to me to be changing. When I read something that doesn't strike me as quite right, it doesn't take long to go to Google and get some differing opinions. And there's whole websites set up to counter urban myths and lies and so forth and so on. It's not that hard to be an aware citizen.
So, we have to dig into this a lot more. We've got some callers waiting, and we got to move to a break. Maybe we'll start with some callers, but we'll dig into these issues a lot more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about propaganda with Jason Stanley from Yale University.
In our next segment, we'll probe the ways in which propaganda can be resisted. Do we need to fight fire with fire? That is, fight propaganda with more propaganda, or is there a better way?
Combating propaganda, when Philosophy Talk continues.
We are providing some straight talk about all the jive talking in which we find ourselves immersed. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And that's not just propaganda. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Jason Stanley from Yale University. And we're thinking about propaganda. We've got a caller on the line. Marty in San Pablo. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marty.
Hi there. Pleased to be here. I've found somewhat problematic the way you folks appear to be defining propaganda. You define it, in effect, as something either deceitful or something in service of something the speaker considers to be bad. And that's a problematic definition, and it unfortunately colors all of your discussion of it. On the left, among other places in the U.S., historically, the term propaganda has been used in a neutral fashion to mean simply the forceful and effective putting forward of ideas. And often the left has used it with respect to ideas that it considers to be A, honest and true, and B, good and positive. And we want to speak of, well, we've got to make our propaganda effective in bringing out the notion of this, that, or the other thing. And certainly the speakers there using the term are not looking to see the word as meaning deceit or something evil. It's difficult when you define something as something I don't like. You started this by saying pornography, I know it when I see it, which of course is a very silly definition. I was once asked by a patient to define what is pornography, and I said, well, pornography is erotica that the speaker happens to disapprove
of. Yeah, Marty, you have a point, but Jason, he makes a distinction that we we kind of ran over quickly between supportive and undermining propaganda, and we've been focusing on the undermining propaganda rather than the supportive propaganda. But I don't want to speak for Jason. Am I right that that's okay. How you would respond to Marty?
Well, it's part of the answer. It's a great question. It's a great point. He's absolutely right. Propaganda is a neutral notion. But even undermining propaganda is a neutral notion. One of my great inspirations is W.E.B. Du Bois's 1926 article, Criteria of Negro Art, where he characterizes propaganda essentially like I do, undermining propaganda, that is. And what he says is he talks about how the black artist has to get white attention. To undermine this sort of bad representation of black. So he recommends appealing to the ideals of the racist ideals of whites to undermine those very ideals. So the caller's absolutely right that you can even undermining propaganda is neutral. You can undermine a negative ideal.
It goes back to the question we set up this segment with. How do we fight propaganda? One way to fight propaganda is with counter-propaganda, with propaganda that undermines the other propaganda. You're interested in rational political discourse. Is that a form of rational political discourse or not?
Well, in a very narrow, constrained, and incorrect way of thinking of rational political discourse, it isn't. But on the correct way, the Kantian way, it is. What is reason? Reason isn't just a logical argument. Reason is also appealing to the humanity of others. You're increasing someone's reason when you get them to see another person who they'd failed to recognize as a human.
But
that's a Kantian view, this kind of propaganda can do.
Wait a minute. I'm a little confused because you think of propaganda, at least, is it only undermining propaganda or some kind of propaganda? You think sidestepping or shortcutting or evading the rational will. We try to manipulate people's feelings and thoughts without going through their rational agency. And I thought that was kind of a hallmark of propaganda for you, but now I'm a little confused.
No, that isn't. That isn't. That's definitely not. And my discussion of positive uses of undermining propaganda, that's clear. The definition of undermining propaganda is just the use of an ideal towards a goal that tends to undermine that ideal.
Wait a minute.
There's no appeal to
rationality. So negative undermining propaganda. So positive, negative undermining propaganda sidesteps the rational will or not?
Negative, bad undermining propaganda would be propaganda that targets a good ideal, like liberty, freedom, rationality, reason, and it would undermine that ideal. Good undermining propaganda of the sort that W.E.B. Du Bois is urging, and Lenin, you find that this in his writings as well, targets a bad ideal and tries to undermine that.
Bad and good the equivalent to rational and irrational? So the bad ones?
No.
I mean, I'm not quite sure what you mean by bad. I'm going to go back to the caller. Is bad just I don't like it? I mean, bad just means
it? Bad means John Perry doesn't like it.
What does bad mean?
Perfectly objective notion.
Bad means, I mean, I'm not a subjectivist or relativist about morality or political ideals. So there's going to be some ideals that are bad, and so I assume racist ideals are morally bad, and so good undermining propaganda would be undermining propaganda. Like take the example of. John Coltrane's version of My Favorite Things and Lauryn Hill's rendition of it in Black Rage. You take a tune that's very much about whiteness and then you replace it, in the case of Lauryn Hill, by lyrics that are very much about the black experience in America. It makes you realize, well, My Favorite Things is really about white aesthetic ideals, and the world is very different from this other perspective. So it makes you question those white aesthetic ideals.
Hemet in San Jose is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Doc, Hemet.
Hello, yes, this is Hemet Singh. I wanted to ask a little more about time being a factor in the rise of propaganda. Earlier, the speakers were talking about how time may factor into members of the community not being able to research certain topics. And I see this as a very, very big problem in modern-day society, where most people are caught up in their professional lives and don't really have the time to spend resources to, you know, study up on many of the issues that, you know, trouble us in the modern day. And I was wondering if you guys could expand a little more on the topic of time.
What do you think about that, Jason? That was your thought.
I think that's a great. I mean, this is so. The original question was how in free and an open society can we get people to believe that certain things are instances of goals are consistent with liberty when they clearly aren't. Certain goals are consistent with safety of, you know, public safety when they clearly aren't. If our society involves us working all the time, well, we cannot do the due diligence required of democratic citizens to evaluate policy on our own. And so it's propaganda becomes effective in a society when we're robbed of the time, and so we give our autonomous decision-making over to experts.
Well, I must say, though, I mean, I think of all societies and all of history, nobody's better positioned than we are with the internet. And admittedly, we work more hours than people in France and Germany, but it's not all that bad. It can't have ever been easier to get propaganda delivered to one, but at the same time, it can't ever have been easier to check it out. And we should be teaching people in school how to do that.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. I do, but I do still wonder. I mean, it's like this, everything in our society is contested and contestable. You can find your expert in X, your expert in Y, your expert in Z. It's not like, well, maybe it is like, are the means of public communication and thought influence, is it really so restricted that there are 1,000 voices vying 1,000 for the imprimatur of epistemic authority? And so I don't think it's this authoritative class just completely manipulating us. But maybe I'm just naive. But education, I want to go back to education for a bit. We were going to ask you, how do you combat that? You told us one thing, fight propaganda with propaganda. That doesn't seem to me like necessarily the most effective. That's kind of downstream. What about education earlier on in the process?
That's absolutely right, Ken, and thanks for asking. The last chapter of my book is about the education system in the United States between 1910 and 1920 and how it was designed as a mechanism for social control. When, for instance, social studies replaced history, education is always a battleground in this country. It's not now. It's been a battle. It has always been a battleground since the 19th century, precisely because a free and open system of education is essential for autonomous decision making in a democratic society. And that's why our education system is such a contested political battleground. Once I taught in Lori Grun's class in Cheshire Correctional Facility, and one of the students in the class told me, I stopped going to school when I realized that I was being taught that I owed everything I have and ever will have to Abraham Lincoln. We need an education system that represents the perspectives of all Americans, not just one perspective that's not designed for social control. I try to explain how the history of our education system was not like that.
But so Jason, the word propaganda, its roots are in the Latin for that's used in the phrase propagation of the faith. And you have to admit that any big successful institution, whether it's a church or a government, even a democratic government, has to propagate certain articles of faith to have continuing the consent of the governed. I mean, so isn't, I guess we're getting into not undermining but positive propaganda, but isn't there a base level that's just required to have a functioning society of patriotic songs and phrases and so forth that nobody until they get to philosophy class really questions?
So that's brilliant. You have just described the views. The modest version of what you have is Walter Lippmann's work, The Phantom Public and Public Opinion. And the scary view is Carl Schmitt, the National Socialist political theorist. Both of them emphasize that pure democratic deliberation is impossible when you have to get things done quickly. And so propaganda is necessary. Schmitt says this makes democracy impossible. Lippmann says, well, we have to somehow restrain propaganda. We'll need propaganda in times of war, but somehow propaganda always gets misused. And so this is why this topic is the foundation of democratic political theory.
It's not just times of war, though. It's times of any extended hard thing to do. You don't want to always have to start over convincing each generation to keep doing it, right? Any kind of thing that binds us together over the generations, it seems we need propaganda of some kind.
This is why when you look at Rousseau and Aristotle and great deliberative, the main deliberative democratic theorists, they say democracy is for a very small state.
Yeah.
But it's a tug of war. We're going to need decisions in a very large society that we have to hand over to experts somehow, but we need to somehow have institutions that check and balance those in a responsible way.
And Jason, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining. It's been a great conversation, non-propagandistic, I might add.
Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University, author of How Propaganda Works. So, John, what are you thinking now, very briefly?
Oh, I'm just thinking about what Jason called positive propaganda and how pervasive it is, even in the way we describe things. We describe the country we live in as the United States of America, but we could describe it as the stolen land from the Native Americans of America or something.
Yeah.
We choose one rather than the other. It confers a whole sense of legitimacy to the idea that we exist because the states exist. We sing the national anthem, America the Beautiful, tears come to my eyes, but it's the phrases that are really propaganda that do the most. So it's a very interesting topic.
Yeah, it is. And you will have to think about it and talk about it some more. And we will, because this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's get to some of the speediest propaganda you've ever heard. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the Committee on Public Information was created by President Woodrow Wilson in 1917. For just over 2 years, it used every media trick available at the time to marshal enthusiasm for the war effort. And World War I not only turned out to be a great victory for the Western powers, it planted the seeds of World War II. Congratulations, history. A star member of the propaganda team was Edward Bernays, who was Sigmund Freud's nephew and a bit of an acolyte as well. Bernays thought propaganda was so great it should be put to peacetime uses. However, since propaganda was a bit of a loaded term, he invented the term public relations, which is like propaganda only for your own good, because democracy is messy. Public opinion needs to be guided, otherwise we are run by mob rules, kind of an enlightened despot approach. And he became a legend in the PR field. He was a key figure in gaining acceptance for women to smoke in public, for instance, by staging demonstrations in which cigarettes were called torches of freedom. Indirectness was his tactic of choice, and the judicious use of third-party testimonies. 9 out of 10 doctors agree. 4 out of 5 dentists recommend. Those were his contributions to the science of public relations. He considered his work to be a public service and a profession like bridge building. He even wrote a book called The Engineering of Consent, which Noam Chomsky gave a nod to in his book, The Manufacture of Consent. Chomsky did not approve of Bernays, perhaps because of his most extreme accomplishment on behalf of the United Fruit Company, which is now Chiquita. In 1954, as a result of their desire in the U.S. government, the democratically elected president of Guatemala was overthrown. Bernays helped things along by branding the man as a communist. The Guatemala kerfuffle is what gave us the term Banana Republic, also the plot line for every other episode of Mission Impossible. Bernays' vision was of a utopian society in which individuals' dangerous libidinal energies, like the Germans under Hitler, could be harnessed and channeled by a corporate elite for economic benefit. The Libertarian Free Market Party did all right, but he seemed a little fuzzy on the, I don't know, greater good part, though he did successfully host the first NAACP convention in Atlanta in 1920 and put together a pancake breakfast with vaudeville actors for Calvin Coolidge. Was that a plus? Well, he worked to vaudevillians, at least. In later years, he had some regrets, apparently, and became a vehement opponent of smoking. He also campaigned in Massachusetts for legislation that required the licensing of PR practitioners. It failed. He died in 1995, aged 103, and so we have the world we have today, run by PR people, lobbyists, and billionaires. And for the rest of us, just go along, and maybe it'll turn out to be a perfect world until the ocean catches fire. But even then, who knows? They'll call it a heated pool and start charging America triple for rent. And freezing to death in the ocean will be a thing of the past. 9 out of 10 doctors agree. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
As a famous man once said, a lie told often enough becomes the truth. That's a great quote. And I'm the one who said it. Yes, that was me. I said that. Now it is mine.